All right. Well, yeah, as those, the clipboard goes around, please sign the clipboard. That's what allows us to keep this class, so yeah, please sign your presence in it. And there's one clipboard for each side. And yes, I'm going to be gone the next 2 weeks. I'll be speaking the next two Sundays in London, England. So we're doing a major conference over there. And eventually be able to get the recordings of that. Gee, I'm speaking what's called the Unbelievable Conference. So
they would qualify.
They would. Well, it's run by a British organization. It likes to have Christians and non-Christians, especially atheists, engage one another. So while I'm there, I'm going to be debating an atheist chemist who's part of the British Humanist Association. So, well, I've done some of these debates on radio and TV where I don't have to go there, but you know, since I'm there, so, and we're doing a number of other media things while I'm there in Britain. But the reason I'm making the announcement is we got a really special treat for you next Sunday. As Mark pointed out, Michael Gillen is going to be speaking here, one of the top Christian speakers in the world. I mean, he's a way more gifted speaker than I'll ever hope to be. He was for 15 years the science correspondent for ABC television. And so, and he was famous for scooping all the other news networks on exciting science shows. So, a very gifted communicator. And I don't know what he's going to be speaking on, but I can tell you this, people often have to pay $20,000 to hear him speak. So we're getting him for free. He's doing this as a gift to us. So definitely bring your friends. He loves engaging non-Christians. So feel free to bring your non-Christian friends. A lot of people know who he is already. So he's also the one who produced the movie Little Red Wagon. So he's been involved in producing several theater-release movies. So, but he's a Christian. A theoretical physicist, taught at Harvard for a number of years, but really good at communicating science to lay people.
So,
He's a visiting scholar with Reasons to Believe right now. Yes. You'll see something on the reasons.org website. They got a little bio on him, but yeah, his bio is very impressive. So. He spoke at the AMP conference, so many of you were at the AMP conference. So, also brings a lot of humor into his messages. Then following him is going to be another really gifted speaker, Mark Perez. So, thank you, Mark. So, Mark is also a visiting scholar. We call him a local scholar at Reasons to Believe. He comes in regularly and engages our scholar team there. Actually working on a book that he's going to do with Ken Samples. So, yeah, for him also, I encourage you, bring your friends and associates, see if we can keep this place full. Okay, we're going to get to these texts in Isaiah, and if you don't have the questions on the book of Isaiah, I brought about 20 of them here with me. So, Mark, if you can give these out to people who don't have them. These are the questions that we're studying in the class. And as we go through the book of Isaiah, we're doing the thing that we're doing with all the other books that we're going through in the Bible. We're looking at the creation and science content. So we're skipping a lot of the other stuff. But Isaiah says more about who God is as a creator than any other book in the Bible. So we'll be spending some extended time here in the book of Isaiah. But before we jump into that, I got some questions last week that I want to address. You know how I kind of quickly went over a scientific discovery about how we should be thanking God for conifers and the way they compensate for the brightening of the sun? Well, a big question I got was, boy, you sure went over that whole part about exactly how rain falling on mountains takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and actually makes our atmosphere less able to trap heat as the sun gets brighter and brighter. I've actually shared this with a class before, but a number of you weren't here when I did that. So let me pull this up for you. Here we go. If you recall, this is the visual I showed you last week. Let's get this thing started. Here we go. Those of you who are not aware of this, that's Cathedral Peak in the Yosemite National Park. And I've showed you this because what you're seeing are conifer trees growing on the steep granite slopes of Cathedral Peak. And actually gets a hold on those things because of some amazing design properties. And incidentally, this will all be explained in some depth at a lay level in the blog that I got coming out tomorrow. Actually, a new scientific discovery saying how it is that these conifers are able to survive on these very steep granite slopes. And it's because they're able to draw water right out of the granite bedrock. And so I was talking about that last week. But I think the question I got after class is, okay, you got rain falling on these granite mountains. How does that pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Well, I try to teach this class with no equations. But to explain this, I'm going to have to show you an equation. And it's not a physics equation. It's a chemistry equation. So how many of you ever took chemistry in high school? Okay. Gee, over half of you took chemistry in high school.
It's been a long time ago.
Long time ago? Okay. Well, this is just a simple chemistry equation. So please don't panic. And this actually shows you mountains in British Columbia that have been heavily eroded, and basically eroded by rain falling on granite. And as rain falls on steep granite, you get the following chemical reaction. Now, granite is basically silicates. So you've got magnesium silicate, you've got iron silicate, you've got calcium silicate. What I got here is for calcium silicate. That's that equation you see right there, CeCaSiO3. SiO3 is a silicate. So that's calcium silicate, reacts with carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the presence of rain falling on the granite. This reaction only works if you've got liquid water from the sky falling upon the granite. And so it's that rain coming down the granite that establishes a reaction where you get a calcium ion plus hydrogen carbonate, and then you get silicon dioxide, which is basically sand. But that calcium ion is highly reactive, so you get a second reaction where you get the calcium ion plus that hydrogen carbonate, and it reacts to become calcium carbonate plus carbon dioxide plus water. But what I want you to notice is that you wind up losing one carbon dioxide molecule. You start with two, you end up with one. Notice you've got water coming out both ends at the same amount. So water acts as a catalyst. It's not absorbed in the reaction at all. It simply acts as a catalyst. But unless you've got that water falling on the silicate, this reaction will not run. So if you haven't got rain, this isn't going to happen. And it needs to be liquid water falling from the sky. Somebody asked me, well, how hard does it have to fall from the sky? The liquid water simply has to make contact with dry silicate. If it makes contact with dry silicate, this reaction runs. But this is what you need to remember. This is the bottom line right here. You start off with a silicate plus carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and you wind up with calcium carbonate plus sand, silicon dioxide. And so what that does is it pulls carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as the reaction runs. And the point I was making last week was conifers have the property that they make this reaction run faster than if all you got are mosses on the silicates. With the mosses on the silicates, the reaction will run, but once you've got conifers, any kind of tree for that matter, it can actually make this reaction run up to four times faster. And so what happens is the sun gets brighter and brighter because of the way God introduces plants on these silicate land masses, progressively introduces plants that are more and more efficient in drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, you know, carbon dioxide in particular. As the sun gets brighter and brighter, our atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient in its capacity to trap heat, keeping the temperature on the surface of the Earth optimal for life. Now, the only way you're going to get these trees growing on the silicates, they need a little bit of soil. They don't need much, but they need a little bit of soil. So long before you got trees on the face of the earth, you got what are called cryptogamic colonies. You say, what on earth are those? Well, you don't see that much around anymore. But for about 2.5 billion years, they were the dominant life form on the silicate land masses. And there's very few places in the world that you can go where you actually can see these things. Basically, where you see them is where you got brand new silicate without any plant material on it or soil, and these cryptogamic colonies will form. And basically, they break down the surface silicate into a very thin layer of soil. But that thin layer of soil is enough to allow the trees to get a start there. And once the trees get a start there, their roots go down into the cracks of the silicate. They expand those cracks, which allows more liquid water to come into contact with the silicate, which makes this reaction run more efficiently. So yeah, another key factor, the reason why trees actually make this reaction run up to 4 times more efficiently, it's because of the root system moving throughout the bedrock that basically, because, you know, roots are powerful. You see this little living tissue getting into a tiny crack, and the root begins to grow, and it's so strong that as it grows, it splits the rock farther and farther apart. And as it splits it farther and farther apart, more liquid water from falling rain is able to come into contact with the silicate and make this reaction run. Now, as I mentioned last week, there's a big benefit from this reaction for human civilization, because this reaction transforms silicates, which is not a very useful material for human civilization, into two materials that are extremely useful, carbonates and sand. So when you drive home on the freeway today, you're driving home on carbonates and sand. That's basically what freeways are, or skyscrapers. Anywhere where you see concrete, it's basically carbonates and sand. And if it wasn't for this reaction, we'd have silicates, which wouldn't be very effective for making that kind of material. And so thanks to billions of years of this reaction running, we got lots of carbonates and lots of sand. But I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago in a class. Because we got 7.5 billion people on the face of the earth, and because those 7.5 billion people are actually engaged in fairly sophisticated technology, we're now running into a shortage of sand and carbonates. And so Asians, for example, are trying to make financial deals with people here in North America to go to our beaches and take the sand and take it back over to Asia and make freeways. Yeah, you probably don't know about this, but don't be surprised if suddenly all the sand on your favorite beaches gets sold to a wealthy Asian for making. I'll tell you where the shortage is the most extreme. It's most extreme in India. India is a huge shortage of sand, and they're trying to get it anywhere they can. But we wouldn't even have the civilization we had today unless this reaction had been running for billions of years. And we wouldn't have it unless we had conifers existing on the face of the earth for a little more than 300 million years. And we wouldn't have it unless God actually very carefully timed which plants are on the planet at which time to make sure the reaction runs at just the right rate that our planet doesn't get too hot or doesn't get too cold. It's been optimal temperature all the way through those billions of years. But hey, I actually have a photograph of cryptogamic crust. Because a couple of years ago, 3 years ago now, I took Kathy to this remote place in British Columbia where they got fresh silicate, and it's at such a high altitude, nothing else grows there except this stuff. Let me kind of push it over. Yeah, here we go. That's what cryptogamic crust soil looks like. Say, what on earth is that stuff? Well, it's about a half inch thick, and it's a dense colony of bacteria and fungi and algae working in symbiotic relationship with one another. And what it does is it takes that silicate, breaks it down into a very thin soil crust. But if you don't have this stuff all over the face of the continental land masses for billions of years, there's no way you can have more advanced plants. So remember your geology class where they talk about how you have all these different geological eras and how you don't get advanced plants till very late in the history of the Earth? It's because you can't have advanced plants until you got these colonies existing on the exposed continental silicates for hundreds of millions, billions of years, so that you can get a thin enough layer of soil or a thick enough layer of soil that you can actually get more advanced plants surviving there. Yes?
Is that like lichen that we see on rocks?
No. This is more primitive than the lichen. This paves the way for lichen. But yeah, once you get this stuff going, then lichen can take a hold. You can get the liverworts taking a hold. Eventually you can get mosses taking a hold, and then you can get the more advanced. So there's a progression. You go from these cryptogamic colonies to the liverworts and to the mosses and the algae, and eventually you can get flowering plants existing there. But yeah, it all begins with this very thin soil produced by this material. And yes?
Oh, is that calcium silicate, is that basalt? Is that the same thing? You know, the first form chemical you
use? Okay. Basalt, if you hydrate it, becomes silicates. And the silicates are actually lighter than the basalts. So that explains where the continents come from. Because you get this water chemically reacting with the basalts to make silicates. That goes on for long enough. The silicates, because they're lighter, will float above the basalts. And eventually they come up above sea level and you've got continents. But by itself, that won't work. You also need that combined with plate tectonics. Because the plate tectonics will buckle that stuff up. And you'll get, you know, material above sea level. Yes?
Will desert sand work as well as beach sand?
Desert sand works just as well as beach sand. So, yeah, we can sell them all that sand. Well, I don't know how many of you live in Duarte. Do I have any people living in Duarte here? Okay, we got a couple right here. You know what Duarte did? They sold one of their backyard mountains to a rock company.
Azusa, not a Duarte.
Azusa's doing it?
Yeah.
Duarte sued Azusa. Duarte sued. Okay, so it's Azusa that sold the mountain. It's on the boundary between Azusa and Duarte. So I've been blaming Duarte all these years. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be doing that. So, yeah, over here.
Doesn't ice play a role in making these cracks bigger, too?
It does, which explains, for example, if I can go back to this one here. Okay, this is in California, Southern California, and in the wintertime you will get ice coming in the cracks as the snow and the rain comes in and freezes. And because frozen water has a greater volume than liquid water, it forces the cracks to get bigger. Now, let me show you one here in Canada. Because they have a much longer winter, you get this process operating for a longer period of time. Notice how much more erosion you get. Okay, it's like, gee, almost half the mountains at the bottom in the form of the little rocks. And I can tell you from personal experience, this stuff is really hard to climb up. You basically take three steps up and 2.5 steps down. So, however, it's really fun to go down that stuff. Going up, it's a pain, yes.
Primitive stuff to flowering plants, seed-bearing plants. That's at the sophisticated end of the spectrum. Why did the biblical translators choose to only mention the sophisticated end of the spectrum of vegetation and not the more primitive forms, which were the only forms that existed at that time in Genesis? What caused them to shift over here from where it should have been?
Okay. The original Hebrew text does not have punctuation in it. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to figure out where the colons go, the commas go, the periods go, the question marks. And, you know, that all gets into our English translation, but the original doesn't have that. So when you look at what it says in creation day three, it says, let the land produce desheh. That's a Hebrew word which means vegetation. Generic. Anything that's photosynthetic comes under that category. So even unicellular photosynthetic life forms would be under that category. Now, I believe that if you were to translate it correctly, let the land produce desheh, colon. Here are three examples. And it mentions three Hebrew words that are typically translated trees, fruit, and seeds. Now, it's also important to realize that in the original Hebrew words for trees, fruit, and seed, they're way more generic than the English equivalents. So when we see the word trees, fruit, and seed, we think apricots. However, if you look at the original Hebrew, the word for tree can refer to any vegetation material that's got some level of stiffness to it. So, for example, a long line of cells that are joined together that have some stiffness in it, that falls under the category of trees. Doesn't come under our category of trees. We think oak trees, firs, apricots, but a stalk of celery, for example, would qualify as a tree based on that term. As I said, even a long line of cells that have some measure of stiffness to it would qualify. Like the word for a seed basically refers to embryo. Well, guess what? Every plant species has an embryo. And likewise, the word for fruit refers to the food that the seed uses to germinate. Well, once again, that's a generic term that would refer to all vegetative material. But I think it's important to realize when it says, let the land produce desheh, here are three examples. It's not meant to be exhaustive. You say, why does it pick those three? Those are the three that people who are not aware of a fossil record would be familiar with. And so given that this is designed to communicate to Christians that are reading the biblical text over a span of 3,500 years, put yourself back 3,500 years ago, would people be aware of cryptogamic crusts? Living in Israel, probably not, unless they went up to some of the higher mountains. Or would they be aware of sulfate-reducing bacteria? Probably not. Or microbes? I mean, those weren't discovered until, 300 years ago. So it's using terms that people at that time would be familiar with. But what impresses me, even in that context, it uses much more generic words than the English equivalent. You know, people always ask me, how come as people speak English that have all these fights over what the Bible teaches about creation? Well, it's because English, you have the greatest challenge in translation. You're taking one of the world's smallest vocabulary languages, namely biblical Hebrew, and translating it into the biggest vocabulary language that has ever existed. So you've got the two extremes. A vocabulary that, if you don't count the names of people and cities, has only 3,000 words. Into a vocabulary that has 4 million words. So we would expect that there would be some translation issues. But the good news is English is where you got the greatest number of translations. I mean, if you're familiar with Bible Gateway, that's a website, it gives you access, I think at current count, it's a little over 40 different English translations of the Bible. And they give them all to you for free. So you can read all 40 for free. I use that with my phone because, one translation will pick up one aspect of the Hebrew, another will pick up a different one. You say, well, which one's which? When you pick up your Bible, always read the preface. The preface will tell you the biases that they use in translation. And so, like the New American Standard Bible will say, what we're trying to do is go for a word-for-word translation. And yeah, we pick one of the words, and they make the whole point. Because if we're going from a tiny vocabulary to a large vocabulary, they may have picked the wrong word, but they try to be word-for-word. Some translations actually try to be literal with the grammar. They want to copy the same grammar that's in the original Hebrew into English. Even the grammar isn't very comfortable for us reading in English because they want to communicate that. The Living Bible, if you read their preface, says, we want to communicate the emotion that's being communicated in the text. So, for example, when I want to show my sons all the humor that's in the Old Testament, I'll probably use the Living Bible because it does a really good job on translating the humor. New American Standard Bible, forget trying to get any humor out of it. It's just not there. So, and you know, when people say, boy, this is really dull, well, hey, you know, read it in a couple of other translations, and you'll get the full sense of what's going on.
So, your answer, if I understood correctly, is after the colon, the three Hebrew words do have a range of interpretation from, could be primitive, it could be sophisticated, it has that wide of a range.
But I'm also saying it's not exhaustive. It's three examples out of hundreds of examples that could have been chosen. And that's why I'm saying, why did it pick those three words? Well, in terms of the words yet available in biblical Hebrew, those are the words that people living 3,500 years ago would have some idea what you're talking about. So, and you say, well, wouldn't it be more accurate if it actually told us exactly what these things were? Well, back then people didn't have a clue. And so, you know, using terms like sulfate-reducing bacteria wouldn't be much help to people living in Moses' generation.
So before the colon, or desh, that is very broad.
The word deshe is very broad, right.
And then the three after
are examples.
Are three specific examples.
Three specific examples out of many. And so that's the problem. The reason why people have fought over that text, they think those three words exhaustively describe the range of what happened on creation day three. There are three examples of the deshe. And a lot of people reading in English don't even figure out, you know, let the land produce vegetation. They go straight to trees, fruit, and seed. So they miss that word deshe, which actually comes first. And so I think in that context, you know, there is no reason to fight over this text or to think it anyway conflicts what we know from the fossil record of plant life.
The word for seed, is that specific or generic?
The word seed, I mean, again, you only got the one Hebrew word that refers to that item that allows the plant to reproduce.
Okay.
A better translation, in my opinion, would be embryo. Okay, and all vegetation has some kind of embryo. Well, because if you were to use the word embryo to someone who lived 3,500 years ago, they would say, what are you talking about? Seed, they understand. So, and keep in mind, you only got that one word. See, in English, we got all kinds of words for different kinds of embryos. But in Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, you just got that one word. But yeah, it would be more accurate, in my opinion, to translate it as embryo, because that would communicate the how generic that Hebrew word is. However, I think the reason why translators use the word seed, that's how people 3,500 years ago would understand it. They wouldn't understand the word embryo. And the principle is this. The Bible is designed to communicate to humans living across 40 different generations. 100 different generations for that matter. And so you want to translate the Bible in a way that would have some meaning for people living across all generations. So for example, nowhere in the Bible where you see a reference to neutrons, even though there are places where you say, well, that'd be really the right term to put in here. But since people 3,000 years ago wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about, it uses something more generic. In fact, we'll see that in one of the texts we're studying this morning. Yes.
Yeah, in support of what you're saying, and back 3,000 years ago when the Bible was written, there were ferns. Ferns are higher plants, but they do not have seeds. They only have spores, you know, and they had them then. So they would have used that same word for the spores, desha, that's the word.
Well, the word that's translated seed, I'm trying to think of the exact, it's zera. Zera is the word for seed, and that would include spores,
right.
As well as...
And they knew about fern. They certainly did, and they would have called them, they would have used that same word.
Well, I'm guessing, too, they knew about seeds where you have just one component as opposed to one that's split into two. So, yeah, I mean, but again, in English, we actually have separate words for all these different kinds of seeds, spores, and embryos. In biblical Hebrew, you got one catch-all term. The problem is when you translate it into English, you can't pick a catch-all term.
What about fruit?
Same thing. The word fruit basically refers to any kind of food supply that sustains the embryo long enough that it can become an adult plant. And again, that's, I mean, again, in English, we think of, well, peaches and apricots, but the truth is there's a food supply for the spore of a fungus that enables it to become a full-grown mold. Mm-hmm. There was a hand over here, yeah.
And one way in which you can think about it that kind of makes the opposite point is that many of the words that we have in this language, we only have one word for snow. And there's an Eskimo tribe I read that has like 13 different words for different kinds of snow.
I've heard it's over 30. There's over 30 different kinds of snow.
They probably think we're completely unsophisticated because we call it all snow. And if they had a story, say, about one particular kind of snow and it was translated into English, we call all those different words snow, the same thing. So that's kind of the way it is with what you're talking about.
Well, I've met some Inuit, and what they tell me is don't try to make an igloo with the wrong kind of snow. It won't work. The reason why they have all these different words for snow is they use these different kinds of snow for different purposes. But they actually have a word for the kind of snow that's optimal for making an igloo. And yeah, if you watch them make an igloo, within an hour, the igloo is completely built. They can do it that fast if they got the right kind of snow. And they basically wait for that kind of snow to form before they make igloos. But where I lived, whenever it snowed, it was useless for making igloos. It was just too wet. If it's too dry or too wet, you can't make igloos out of it. And it's got to set for a period of time before it's actually can be cut into blocks that have got some strength. There's a question back here somewhere? No? Yeah?
I was just going to say that our skiers do talk about different kinds of snow. They talk about powder and other things.
Yeah, you do. And
slushy snow.
Well, what I remember is when you're doing cross-country skiing, they talk about different kinds of snow, how you actually wax your skis for those different kinds, and they actually have different words. So we actually do have words for different kinds of snow. But for those of us who don't do cross-country skiing and don't build igloos, it's just snow, right? Here in California, how many of you have even seen snow, okay? All right. Yeah, well, I keep remembering how we would entertain these students from South Asia, and they had never seen snow before. It was always a real treat in wintertime to take them up to Mount Baldy where they get to see snow for the first time. Just what a wonder it was for them. And I think there's something important about that. That's in one of our verses in Isaiah about creation, that every bit of it should cause us to be awestruck by what we see. And yeah, I mean, we take snow for granted, but I remember looking at the faces of these students from Southeast Asia. And when they saw that snow coming down from the sky, you'd think that they were looking at the seven wonders of the world, because it was just such an awesome thing that they were watching, this white stuff coming down and how it actually, you could taste it and it would refresh you. Okay. All right. No more questions. Let's jump into our Isaiah text. Okay. Okay, these are the different texts that pertain to God creating the universe. That's question one on our sheet here. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to blast through really quickly the passages we've been looking at for the past 3 or 4 weeks, and then I'll stop when we get to one we haven't covered yet, okay? So beginning with Isaiah 6:3, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. His glory fills the whole earth. And what we discern from that, this text is telling us, that every part of God's creation reveals God's glory. So that would refer to a cockroach. It would refer to some particle of dust in the asteroid belt. Every bit of it communicates God's glory. And it's actually an exhortation. We need to look for that glory in everything we see in creation. You know, if it looks ugly, you're not really seeing the glory of God. It's So get past what you think is ugly. And then Isaiah 14:24, the Lord of hosts has sworn, as I have purposed, so it will be as I have planned it, so will happen. And our discussion revolved around how this text is telling us there are no accidents or random outcomes in God's creation. Everything's under his control. Every outcome and event has a purpose. A lot of it seems random and chaotic to us. In fact, we talked about how it must seem random and chaotic to us in order for us to even possibly exist. I won't go into the details. That took about half the class time, so I'm not going to repeat that. Isaiah 14:27, the Lord of hosts himself has planned it. Therefore, who can stand in its way? It is his hand that is outstretched, so who can turn it back? And we discern that this text is telling us nothing stands in the way of God's purposes and plans. In Isaiah 37:16, the Lord of hosts, God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim, that's a reference to the higher angels, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth, you made the heavens and the earth. Making the point that God is the only agency of creation. There is no other factor. Notice this text is contrasting God with the cherubim. These are the greatest and most powerful of the angels, and says, nope, they don't have the power. I'm the only one that's got the power to create. There is no one else and no other factor. You know, here we have physicists speculating today that some impersonal agency did a lot of this stuff. This text is telling us, no, it's God and God alone. Yes?
Was Lucifer included in the class of cherubim?
Lucifer is not referred to as part of the cherubim. The cherubim are 100% committed to God, so Satan wouldn't be in that category. But Satan is referred to as the most powerful of the angels that God created. We're going to come up with another text that implies not even Satan has the power or capacity to create. God alone. Okay, that's where you're going? Yeah. Well, it's important because there's a lot of theology that's crept into the Christian church making the point that God challenged Satan to create. And he messed it up so badly, God says, no, I'm going to take over. The problem with that theology is these texts in Isaiah tell us even Satan doesn't have that power. It's within God alone the capacity to create. Okay, Isaiah 40, verse 5, the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. As many of you realize, this made it into George Handel's Messiah, where, again, he chose this text for the Messiah, making the point, God's glory is evident to every human being. Every human being has heard. The Lord has spoken it, and because God has spoken it so clearly through creation, everyone has the capacity to see God's glory. And you say, well, how come some people claim they've never seen the glory of God? They haven't looked. A lot of us don't look, and especially those of us living in big cities, we don't go outside and look. You won't see it if you just stay in your office. You got to go outside and take a look, but it's been revealed to everyone. Yes?
Why is it the future tense?
Why is it in the future tense? The glory of the Lord will be revealed. All mankind together will see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Basically making the point, if you actually expose yourself, you will see it. That's why I was making the point. Yeah, a lot of people claim, hey, what the Bible says is totally fallacious. I know lots of people who don't see the glory of God. Well, you have to go outside and actually look. And this is a promise. If you go and look, you will see it. But the responsibility is upon us. So basically God is telling us, it says in Romans 1:19, we're all without excuse. Because God has clearly revealed himself and his attributes through the creation, but the responsibility is on us to actually read the book of nature. And yeah, thousands of years ago, everybody was reading the book of nature. Today, there's lots of people who simply haven't taken advantage of reading that book of nature. Yes, Doug?
And of course, that was an incomplete glory, right? That's incomplete, that glory.
Right. So, well, it's basically making a promise, too. The more you look, the more of God's glory you will see. And so, hopefully when you get exposed to God's glory, through the Book of Nature. It'll get you so excited, you're going to want to see more. That's one of the reasons why our team at Reasons to Believe every week puts out a new article. Here's a new discovery from nature that reveals the glory of God. Every day, we're seeing more of God's glory revealed in nature. But again, you got to go out and look. And in some cases, we don't go out inside and look. We read the scientific journals. In the scientific journals, we see people, often against their own will, revealing the glory of God. Yes?
Would you define the word glory as it's used in verses like this?
Okay. Big debate over exactly what does this glory mean. People have talked about it reveals the majesty of God, the power of God. And so the word glory is kind of a catch-all term for God's great attributes. Some scholars acclaim it also includes God's holiness, which is why when we look at the book of nature, there's a sense of awe and fear that comes over us when we recognize what I see in nature is a God that is righteous. In fact, we're going to see some texts that explicitly tell us this, that the heavens, the universe that God created, reveals the righteousness of God, referring to the fact that he is holy. When we look at that and we look at ourselves, we realize he's holy, I'm not. And what does that mean about me? However, as we go through some of these texts, it makes the point that God is the creator and the savior, which communicates that God designed the universe in such a way that we could gain the righteousness we don't have. So we're coming to that. I mean, that's what's wonderful about this. In fact, I argue if all you look at is Isaiah, you can see the plan of salvation laid out in the book of Isaiah just by looking at what God says about the creator of the universe, which is why we're kind of going through all these passages, you know, step by step. It reveals us. But yeah, glory is basically talking about all the great attributes of God and how much greater they are than what we have. I mean, we reflect the glory of God. There's a glory in every human being. In fact, one counselor told me, the secret to being a good counselor is no matter how much trouble the person is in you're talking to, look for the glory of God revealed in that person to help that person see how God has made them as a reflector of his glory. That's kind of step one to actually say, you know what, I guess my problems aren't that big. There's a God out there that's bigger than I am, and I got hope that I can get past these things that could be a problem. Okay. And Isaiah 40, verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or marked off the heavens with the span of his hand? Who has gathered the dust of the earth in a measure? Okay, now God doesn't really have a hand. God is spirit. But this is a figure of speech is being used to make the point that we have a creator who created the universe in such a way that every little drop of water, every little speck of dust was created by God. It has a purpose. It's been measured by God. He knows exactly how much it is. And if he does that with a speck of dust, with a drop of water, where he carefully measures it, he's got a purpose for it. He's determined it. What does it say about you and me? Aren't you bigger and more complex than a speck of dust or a drop of water? Okay, Isaiah 40, 22. And this is where we ended. So I'm going to have you get involved here because this is where we ended last week. Isaiah 40, 22. God is enthroned above the circle of the earth. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like thin cloth and spreads them out like a tent to live in. Okay, what is this text saying about the universe, the creation event, and about God and his role in creation? And it's saying a bunch of things. This is a very compact text here. And actually, we're going to come back to it because I got a question on that sheet for you where we talk about what does Isaiah say about the configuration of the earth. And this is one of the texts in Isaiah that addresses the configuration of the earth. So.
Word, Hebrew word, circle. Is it legitimate? Say it's referring to a sphere.
Okay. Earlier we were talking about how the Hebrew vocabulary is very much smaller than the English vocabulary. In English, we got a separate word for circle and sphere. In Hebrew, they got one word that can mean either one. So you could translate this passage, God sits enthroned above the orb of the earth, or the sphere of the earth, or the circle of the earth. Those are all legitimate translations of this text. Doug? Yeah, and that's Greek.
Greek is very precise, right?
Well, yes, but it's not as challenging as putting into the English.
Okay.
The Greek vocabulary was much bigger than the Hebrew vocabulary, but nowhere near the size of the English vocabulary.
Really? Because I've heard about all the different tenses and all that.
The grammar is more precise. Because, the problem with Hebrew is you don't have a very precise grammar. But in Greek, you got a very precise grammar. It's more precise than English. But you're dealing with a vocabulary size that's about a factor of 4 or 5 times bigger than biblical Hebrew, rather than a factor of 100,000 times bigger, like you got in English. So, it's a challenge, and that's why it took the Hebrews so long to translate their Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. But what happened was, after the destruction of the second temple, the first temple, the diaspora, you had Jews being scattered all over Europe and near Western Asia. And so in the second century B.C., Koine Greek was kind of the common language, kind of like what English is today. Where no matter what your native language is, you probably know English as a second language. It was like Greek was like that. The Romans knew Latin and Greek. The Hebrews knew Hebrew and Greek, or Aramaic and Greek. So no matter what language was your native language, you also knew Greek, which is why the New Testament was written in Greek, because it could communicate to these people living in all these different provinces of Parthia and the Roman Empire. But even in the second century, the Jews said, hey, we got synagogues all over the Greek Empire. We need to translate the Old Testament into Greek.
Well, no doubt God planned it that way, but do you think that it was mostly because of Alexander the Great conquering a lot of the known world?
Certainly. Yeah. No, that's definitely true. I mean, that did not happen until after the establishment of the Greek Empire. And that's what kind of inculcated Greek as a language into all these different national groups. So that became a critical vehicle for taking the gospel message to all these different peoples. It was written in a language that most of them had some access to. Okay, God is enthroned above the circle of the earth. We already talked about how that word for circle could be sphere, orb, or circle. A number of scholars have made the point, it really doesn't matter which one you use, because it says God sits enthroned above the earth. Okay, think of some NASA photo of the earth from outer space where you actually get to see the whole of the earth. What does it look like? Looks like a circle. Okay, so any photo of the earth from, say, hundreds of thousands of miles away is going to show the earth as a circle. Because, it photographs two dimensions. So people have made the point, hey, forget about whether it's talking about the earth being a flat disk or being a sphere. If God is enthroned above the earth, there's only one object that always looks like a circle, and that would be a sphere. A disk does not look like a circle from all different perspectives above, but a sphere always looks like a circle from every perspective above. So people have argued, hey, this idea that the Bible is a flat earth book. Many years ago, I debated the president of the Flat Earth Society on radio. He was trying to claim that the earth was a flat earth book, and I said, well, give me a passage. Interestingly, he quoted this one, and saying this proves that the earth is flat, because it says it's a circle. So he says, it's a disk. And I said, oh, you mean it doesn't have corners? And I said, what do you do with a text that talks about the four corners of the earth? And so he says, well, he basically got off the line, and that was the end of the debate. So I was hoping that he would stay on the radio a little longer, because it was going to make the point, the the word for corners that you see used in Scripture, because Hebrew is such a small language, it can also be translated the four quarters of the earth. And think of an orange that you cut up into quarters, okay? You get a different figure of speech. Again, the problem being is people were trying to discern the Bible as a flat earth book because they're looking at the English translation and taking a very narrow definition of the words rather than looking at the original Hebrew. Yes?
On the second sentence, you stretched out heaven to live in. Is the subject of that sentence, is that talking about mankind or is it talking about God himself? Do you understand what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah, it's basically saying God is the one that does all this. But let me stop for a minute because this whole debate about how to interpret the circle of the earth, it says its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. That tells you that God is far enough away from the earth and looking down on the earth as a circle that we creatures look like little grasshoppers. So we're not talking God being just, you know, 5,000 feet above the surface of the earth. He's far enough away that we look like grasshoppers. And basically making the point, hey, if you look at the universe, we are, in the words of Carl Sagan, just an insignificant speck in the vastness of the universe. But we're an important speck. So, but yeah, in that context. Yes,
I think Steve. You made a good point before, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that if we were on a mountaintop, or they were, and looking down, seeing people as grasshoppers, the view 360 degrees would be a circle to us. It's at a lower elevation as than a space shot, but it's the same idea.
Yeah. That's true, but if you're up on a high enough mountain, you can actually see some of the curvature of the earth. So some of you have actually done that. Although the flat earth people I know say, oh, that's just refraction. You're not really seeing the curvature of the earth. And I'm saying, well, how do you explain the fact that when you're up high, you get to see a lot farther away than if you're down in the plane in spite of the refraction? Because we can measure the refraction effect. It's not just refraction. You're actually able to see farther away, and that's why they always put a sailor up in the crow's nest of a sailing ship, because that put him high enough above the deck that he could see a little farther away, and the world was really flat, he could see a little bit farther away, but not much. Yes?
You can pick up curvature from about a mile.
Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah, you don't need much.
If you're in Malibu Canyon, you can look back at the beach, you can actually pick it up.
So, where, I mean, I've been in airplanes at 45,000 feet, it's really obvious at that elevation. You can see the curvature quite well. So, okay, you were bringing the question up, what about he stretches out the heavens like a thin cloth and spreads them out like a tent to live in? And I chose this translation because it actually makes the whole point that we're talking. It talks about the material that makes a tent, but actually there is this connotation we're talking a thin cloth layer rather than a thick cloth layer. So, any comments on this? Yes?
Well, yeah, reminding me of the universe being spread out and that it's nothing in the middle, we're just like on the skin of a balloon. There's the universe, that's what I got from it.
Right. Yeah, and this passage is actually repeated. You'll actually see other texts that talk about how God stretches out the heavens kind of like a tent which we can live in. And there's debate. Is this just simply a figure of speech? Is it actually implying that the universe is a surface effect? I could go either way on it because, after all, we're only talking about two texts in the Bible that address this thing. But I find it interesting is that even if you take it literally rather than as a figure of speech, it's accurate in the sense that, all the stuff of the universe is on the surface. There's nothing outside, there's nothing inside. If you keep in mind that we're talking a three-dimensional surface instead of a two-dimensional surface. Please don't try to visualize it, it can't be done. But analogy I've used with lay audiences is to say, the universe as we astronomers measure it is kind of like planet Earth, where planet Earth is three dimensions. And we human beings live in the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. When it comes to the universe, all the stars, galaxies, planets, all the space-time dimensionality, all the energy is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. So just add one dimension to the Earth and it all makes sense, as long as you don't try to visualize it. So, but yeah, and that sense is consistent with this text, which is basically saying that the universe is akin to a tent, because that's what a tent is, right? The reality of the tent is not what's inside the tent or beyond the tent. It's the cloth that makes up the tent. And it actually creates a place that we can live. Well, likewise, because of the way God designed the surface of the universe, the three-dimensional surface of the universe, we can live in this universe. Because, yeah, what if it wasn't a three-dimensional surface in a four-space-time dimension? You can't visualize it, but we wouldn't be able to live here. If it was, but if we were actually thinking of something that had interior and exterior to it, it would not be a habitable universe. So
the universe, where the singularity was, is...
Yeah, you don't want to be there.
That's hollow, so to speak. There's nothing there. There's no planets or stars there anymore because they're out here instead of...
Well, one of the most common questions I get is this idea, Hugh, you're an astronomer. Tell me where the center of the universe is. And I said, well, that's akin to you asking me a question, which city on the surface of the Earth is at the center of the Earth? And the answer is they're all the same distance from the center. Nothing, no city is at the center of the Earth. Well, likewise, there's no location on the space-time surface of the universe that's at the center of the universe. I mean, there's not even space and time there. And beyond the surface, there's no space and time. Space and time is constrained to the surface of the universe, just like our transportation system is constrained to the surface of our three-dimensional Earth. You can't drive a freeway to the surface to the center of the Earth. And you can't take a freeway to get to the moon. You have to use other means of transportation to get there. So if you've got a car and doesn't have wings, you're constrained to the surface of the Earth. Well,
the center of the Earth has physicality to it. And so you're saying, like, at the point of the Big Bang, there's nothing there anymore, it's just all expanded out?
Okay. If you go back in time to the very beginning of the universe, yeah, that's the point from which everything came from.
But no more.
Well, it's because the universe has expanded from that. So, quote, the center of it all, of its beginning, is simply not accessible. When we astronomers look out at the universe, we're constrained to look along the surface. However, we can get a little closer to that point than you can looking out across the street here, because as we look far away, we're looking back in time. And as we look back in time, we're looking at the surface of the universe being smaller than it is today. And in that sense, being closer to that point of beginning, which some people refer to as the center.
But it wasn't really an explosion or a bang per se, was it? It was like something different.
Well, astronomers really don't like the analogy that the universe is like an exploding bomb or a grenade. Because when you if I were to explode a grenade here in the classroom, some pieces of the grenade would move faster than other pieces. What we see with the universe, everything is moving at the same velocity, which is why they prefer the word picture of blowing up a balloon. Because you blow up a balloon, that surface of the balloon moves away from the center of the expansion at the same rate everywhere. Assuming you've got a balloon that doesn't have weaker surfaces on it. And so everything is the same distance from that center, but there's no access to that center.
So the universe is flat, kind of, but curved.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you get the Crater and the Cosmos, the latest edition, I talk about how we astronomers can now measure the shape of the universe. And our measurements tell us it doesn't look like it's spherical, it doesn't look like it's saddle shape, it looks like it's flat. But it's flat in four dimensions, not in two dimensions. It's four-dimensional flat universe. Don't try to visualize it. Okay, keep this in mind. One of the reasons why we know Christianity and the Bible is from God, it contains teachings we can't visualize. One reason why we know all the other holy books are not from God, their content is limited to that which we can visualize. That's evidence that they came from a human being, because it shows limitations of human visualization. The Bible, as you notice, is unique in claiming that God is a Trinity. It's unique in claiming that God controls everything but gives us free will. You don't see that in the other religions. It's unique to Christianity because it's beyond what we can visualize. And you say, well, how do we know that's true? Physics and astronomy are loaded with all kinds of things we know for certain are true, but we can never visualize it. So yeah, one of the things you have to do in trying to communicate the Christian gospel to people who are not yet Christians is say, there is truth out there that you can't visualize. Because I've known a lot of people say, I won't accept this gospel you're telling me until I can completely visualize it. Can't be done. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
This idea of a comment and a question. This idea of a four-dimensional universe on a two-dimensional sphere or surface has come up before. Sometimes I've heard it explained differently as raisin bread, where
right.
Different objects are in an expanding loaf of bread. And we're somewhere in the loaf, and we don't know where the edges of the bread is. Just we know that everything's expanding, and we don't know where the center is.
Yeah, you're right, and astronomers don't like that analogy. They prefer an analogy where all the raisins are on the surface of the expanding loaf. That's actually closer to reality. Okay, good.
But I've not discovered that. I asked an astronomer over at Carnegie Institution over here in Pasadena on the open house day what he thought about this, and he said, well, you must remember, at whatever you call the beginning, whatever we see observable now or what that beginning was, we don't know what's beyond. It could extend forever. We just don't know. He says there are some indications, but we don't know. We're in the center of something. We're in the midst of something. So my question to you is maybe a suggestion, not an RTB book, but something that an RTB book would support, about the four dimensions or three dimensions on a two-dimensional surface that we could find on our computer browser to help us.
Yeah, they all have limitations. Because what all these astronomers are trying to do is kind of give you an analogy for what the geometry of the universe is like. The problem is almost every lay reader doesn't like the analogy.
We're just even looking for anything.
Yeah.
Well,
one thing I can share with you is that the loaf with raisins in it that's rising with as the yeast expands it, that's not as good an analogy as a balloon with raisins on the surface.
So if you can come with a website or something sometime to help us, because we're going to do this, Mr. Mike, and you're maybe four or five times, and we sort of all go in on.
Well, there's lots of websites, Steve, that use the balloon analogy where they put dots on the balloon. Those are the best. But keep in mind, those analogies also are incomplete. And I'd like to follow up, too, about what your astronomer friend at Carnegie said, where we got some idea of the geometry of the universe. And you'll see this in the Crater in the Cosmos, fourth edition. Yeah, we now can measure the geometry of the universe to four places of the decimal. But that's probably the best we'll ever be able to do, regardless of advancing technology. There's actually things inherent in Big Bang cosmology that make it impossible to determine the geometry any more accurately than that. But the four places of the decimal, it looks like it's flat. But it still leaves the door open that it could be slightly spherical or slightly saddle-shaped. And the sad news is, we'll probably never know. Expanding flat balloon where the balloon has four dimensions of space and time.
Okay,
Okay, that's close.
Not a hot water bottle.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think what I said earlier is significant in the sense that if it were any different than this thing we can't visualize or imagine or come up with a decent analogy to communicate it, we wouldn't be here. It's got to be in this unimaginable context for there to be a possibility of physical life in the universe. So stop trying to visualize it, and you'll find the best analogies you can on the web. As I think the ones that come the closest are basically the balloon.
It's spherical.
But it's spherical, yeah. I mean,
it's an expanding pancake, and we're on the surface.
Well, I mean, some of the better websites I've looked at say, you know, it could be an expanding saddle shape. But you can't blow up a saddle, so. So the bottom line is all analogies for the expanding universe break down. And don't be surprised about that. All analogies we have for the Trinity at some point break down. I mean, that's kind of what I did in Beyond the Cosmos, is give you what I thought were the best analogies for the biblical doctrine of the Trinity. But even the best analogies fail to communicate what the Trinity is really all about. So we have to be satisfied with communicating some of the truths of Big Bang cosmology. Don't try to explain it all. It can't be done. And I think the astronomer you talked to said it right. I mean, we have some understanding, but there's limitations. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering if flatness could be interpreted as conformity to perfect sphericity, that it doesn't deviate from a perfect sphere.
No, there's a big difference between flat and sphere. And you know, how astronomers do this, they measure something called the critical density of the universe. And so if it's less than one, it is saddle-shaped. Or pardon me, more than one, it's saddle-shaped. Less than one, it's, more than one, it's spherical. Less than one, it's saddle-shaped. If it's exactly one, it's flat. So flat is that boundary line between a saddle-shaped universe and a spherical universe. And so it's either flat or very, very slightly saddle-shaped or very, very slightly spherically shaped. And as I was just mentioning earlier here, we may never know which one it is. But it's got to be really close to flat for us to be here. Now, I think what's fun, there's actually research being done now that might establish that it slightly departs from flatness, and they're actually looking at it in terms of context. What do we need to get advanced life in the universe? If it's perfectly flat, does that eliminate the possibility of life? And maybe there's a very slight departure. And then again, how many places of decimal does that to be flat for us to be here? These are still unanswered questions. You had a comment.
Well, you know how pita bread has a little hollow space in
the whole thing? Oh, pita bread, okay.
Healthy pita bread. I'm going on record.
Okay. Now, where are you going to put the raisins?
No raisins.
No raisins. Okay, over here, Doug.
I hope people don't mind me saying this, but my wife has little interest in this stuff at all, and even less knowledge about it, I think. And I love to talk about this stuff. When we die, am I going to understand more about it? And is she going to understand more about it, do you think, even if she doesn't want to understand more about it? And am I going to be able to talk to her about it, or is that a wait and see kind of
So what's this class going to be like when we're in the new creation? Is that your question?
We'll recognize each other.
Well, I'll go to 1 Corinthians 2:9. It's going to be beyond anything that any of us can think or imagine. I don't think we're going to be talking about this kind of stuff at all. We're going to be talking about something far more wondrous. And yeah, I don't think our curiosity will ever go away. God made us curious, and we get a new creation. We're going to be in a nonstop college course learning about the glory of God, and it's going to be really fun. And we're all going to be excited about it. But the stuff we're talking about now, it's like, it's old hat. So we had that figured out a long time ago. Yeah. There's a question here somewhere? Okay. Yeah.
Since we're going to get a whole new universe, you're probably not going to care about this one.
Yeah. Well, I think what's going to happen, God's going to say, you know, you probably wondered why I made the universe the way I did. And I know you got some good answers, but let me tell you the whole story. So he'll tell us that. And the angels are going to be listening. Yeah, yeah, we want to know too why you made it this way.
Or and, you might scratch your head and go, oh, that's all.
Or you might want to say, well, what was my role in all of this? I can understand why you made all these angels and all these other people, but why me? And God will explain to us why we played a critical role. And then we're going to want to know everybody else's critical role. I mean, hey, you got eternity, so there's going to be a lot of stuff for us to explore. Okay, over here.
Okay, this is going to sound a little weird, but one of the things that the Lord showed me is that one of the things that we do in heaven is we get together and we pray, and we're actually creating things with our prayers. And actually, when we meet in the prayer group down here, each person is very valuable in the prayer group because that's what they're actually doing, is we're learning how to cooperate with God and whether it's his plans and his things are here.
Well, you're making a good point. In the new creation, we're not going to be sitting on harps or on clouds playing harps. God's got a task for each one of us to do. He says, I'm going to make you caretakers with me of the new creation. So every one of us is going to be a manager, and we're going to have a task in managing a component of God's creation. So as I've explained here in the class before, our life here in these few decades we have on this planet, it's all training, preparing us for future careers in the new creation. This is why we're not to take life lightly. Over here, and then I want to get back to, because I'm going to running out of time. Go ahead. Okay, New Jerusalem, the new creation. Revelation 21 speaks about a time when the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. God created the universe to be a tool to eliminate evil and suffering. And when that happens, as he spoke the universe into existence, he'll speak it out of existence, and then he brings in the new creation. As it tells us in John 14, Jesus told his disciples, I'm going away to prepare a place for you. It's a brand new creation, not this universe. I say this because there's a lot of teaching going on today saying we're going to spend eternity here on earth. Yeah. One reason why I think that can't possibly be true, I think God's going to save a lot more than just 1 or 2 billion of us, in which case we need something bigger. And that's where the New Jerusalem comes in, because it tells us in Revelation 21 that here's this new earth, and the New Jerusalem comes out of heaven and sits on the earth. But it talks about this angel with a measuring rod, and he measures the size of the city that comes out of... Now, keep in mind, we're probably not talking length, width, and height, but it is a realm of dimensions, because you see in Revelation 21 that it's actually measuring the sizes of the different features. It talks about this angel with a measuring rod. And when you look at the measurements given there, it tells us that the New Jerusalem measures 1,500 miles approximately on one side, 1,500 miles on another, and 1,500 miles on a third. Now, I don't know how many dimensions of space there are in the new creation, but it tells us this is a structure that, in the equivalent of our three dimensions of space, measures 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. Now, again, in the context of what we can visualize in three space dimensions, that means the structure is either a pyramid or a cube, or maybe some other exotic three-dimensional object. But that thing wouldn't really fit on our Earth. Our Earth is too small to accommodate something of that size. This is a single building that resides on the new Earth, which tells me the new Earth has a whole lot more living space than our planet. And, well, yeah, well, it tells us there's no death. It tells us there's no darkness. And if you've got this building, it tells us there's no gravity. Because if there's gravity, you're not going to have a building 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. Gravity will remove the corners. And the text is explicit. This building has corners, because it talks about the different cornerstones of the building. Now, there's certain jewels at the base of those cornerstones. So that tells us there's no gravity, or we're talking a very different kind of force than the force of gravity, because this is something that can sustain structures of those great dimensions. And some scholars have speculated the New Jerusalem might be an apartment complex where we all get a flat, and you can leave that flat anytime you want. So, in large cities of the world, for example, they have these big buildings where maybe 20,000 people live in the building because they all have flats. And say the first six floors are movie theaters and restaurants and department stores, laundromats, lawyer offices, all that kind of stuff, doctor's offices. And basically, you don't have to leave the building. Everything's there. So, and if you go to the big Asian cities or places like Toronto, you can see those kinds of building structures. And people have said, well, maybe the New Jerusalem is like that. It's a place where you've got a flat, but it's not a place to where you're confined. You've got access to the entirety of the new earth and the new heavens. So you can come and go. But what's interesting, you can put 30 billion human beings in that building if it's got a cubicle type shape, where every one of us in just our apartment flat could have two championship golf courses and a ski run with 10,000 vertical feet. Every individual can have something that big. So it just shows you this New Jerusalem actually has a larger living space than the entire surface of planet Earth. And yet we're not limited. That's just where. So when it says, I'm making a mansion for you, we're talking way bigger than the mansions you see in Arcadia. Way bigger. Yes.
Okay, if all redeemed humanity are living inside that New Jerusalem, then who or what is outside on the rest of the earth? What will we be managing?
Well, interesting question, because all I see in the text is that we're going to be ruling over the angels and the kingdoms God creates. And, you know, what are those kingdoms? Are that new species of life forms? So are we going to be managing the equivalent of bears and lions that are existing in multiple dimensions and are, eating whatever, or maybe they don't eat at all? I don't know. So God may be creating, and people have speculated, maybe he's going to create intelligent life forms. After all, he made the angels, he made us. Maybe he's got in mind another species, and we're going to be ruling over them. Who knows what that means, that word the kingdom means? Leaves a lot of room for speculation. I like to go back to 1 Corinthians 2:9. Whatever God does in that new creation is greater, more glorious, more loving, more rewarding than any one of us can think or imagine. Which tells me, let your imagination run wild and realize it's greater than that. And incidentally, that's an exhortation from both the author of Hebrews and the Apostle Paul. Both of them made the point, every day as a follower of Jesus Christ, spend some time meditating about how great you think your future reward will be. Whatever you come up with, it's better than that. So I'm out of time, but I'll take one more quick comment.
You know what really puzzles me about this, though, is Jesus said, narrow is the gate that enters to heaven, and few are they that find it. And then there's another passage where Paul says, or this is Peter, where he says that the righteous are scarcely saved. And so I think there's a lot of mystery about how many people are going to be there.
Well, there is. And so, for example, scholars who are making the point that this planet Earth is going to be our eternal home, they're basically pointing out to that passage. Narrow is a gate. You know, we're not talking 10% of humanity becoming followers of Jesus Christ. We're talking 0.1%. Well, what does that say about all of us here in the class if it's only 0.1%? But the passage I lean on is the one that's in Zechariah 13. Where it says, a day will come when a third of all the living Jews will recognize the one that they have pierced and they'll worship him. Which communicates a day will come when a third of all living Jews will become followers of Jesus Christ. Now, Jesus did make the point repeatedly. Narrow is the gate, it will not be a majority. But I think he was also making the point, it will not be a tiny minority, it's going to be a big minority. So it won't be 50%, it won't be 80%, but it could be 30%. It could be 35%.